One of the biggest news stories has been changes in the communist world, and one certainly hopes that that will eventually mean better relations between those countries and the United States. It has also led some commentators to speculate, perhaps only half jokingly, if our enemies become our friends, what will we do for enemies? It seems as if we have a need for enemies, that there is something driving us at a very deep psychological level that causes us to seek out enemies. And we'll talk about that idea this morning as we talk with Dr. Volkha. He has written a book on this topic. The title of his book is The Need to Have Enemies and Allies. It was published in 1988. He is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Virginia Medical School. He's also a medical director at the Blue Ridge Hospital in Charlottesville, Virginia. And he's talking with us by telephone this morning. As we talk about this idea, Do we need to have enemies? Is it a psychologically driven need? You're certainly welcome to call in if you have questions or comments. We'd especially like to know your thoughts on this topic. Our telephone number here locally is 333-9455. We have a toll-free line as well, so that no matter where you are, you can use that number and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455. Just bear in mind that the numbers are not the same. The exchange, the three numbers there, the first three numbers are different. 333-WILL locally, 800-222-WILL for the toll-free line. Dr. Volkha, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate you giving us some of your time.
Thank you very much.
As I understand it from having looked at your writing, it seems that the need for enemies, or the fact that we have enemies, is something that begins in our childhood, as we very early begin to have fear, suspicion of strangers, and it has something to do with the way that we get rid of feelings that we may have. Maybe they're about ourselves, maybe they're just sort of general feelings. It's a way of getting rid of stuff that we don't like, and so we take it and we, in a sort of a symbolic way, we stick it on to somebody else as a way of getting rid of it, and that way of dealing with those things that we don't like is something that we continue to do throughout our lives.
Well, you are making a very good summary of what I say in the book. May I also remind you that I speak also of the need to have allies, so that it is a balanced view. Not only we put onto others or other things some unacceptable ideas and feelings, we also put some very soothing Very comforting feelings and thoughts onto others in order to patch up our hurts and grievances. So not only we create enemies and in our minds, but also we create allies. And the issue that I am dealing with is not in regard to the individual per se. I am trying to find out, how do we do these things collectively? So I'm more interested why one ethnic group needs to have an ally and may find an enemy in its neighbors, among its neighbors, or one nation group fights with the other nation group, and after a while, as now you can see, now we are developing allies with Russians. And so it's a fluctuating situation, and my book deals with the meaning of this and the beginnings of this.
Is it related to, that is the way that nations operate, large groups of people operate, is that related to, or does it work according to the same sort of set of rules that individuals do? I mean, is it...
Yes, and with some addition. In what I am trying to say is that, let's say that I have some unacceptable thing about myself, let's say, angry feelings or degrading feelings about myself. And as a child, I say, for example, I am not the one who has fallen down. It is the doll who has fallen down. I mean, you know how kids do.
Mm-hmm.
They say, it is not me, it is my sister, and so on. And as we grow in our childhood within a neighborhood or within an ethnic group, the adults in our environment, they kind of choose for us certain kind of targets for the children to consider bad or good. And this is the beginning of sharing certain targets as good or bad. And so collectively, within one group, we may choose, due to our childhood experiences with other children as well as with adults, we may choose another group as the enemy. And so that, and we choose our own group as the ally. And later on in child development, these kind of things, they gel in more sophisticated conceptualizations like ethnicity, nationality. And the idea of ethnicity or nationality, they become part and parcel of our own selves and our own belongingness. So what you see under stress, if you put an ethnic group under stress, they rather die than change their ethnicity. Let me give you examples so we may understand what I'm saying much better instead of doing this kind of theoretical talking.
Okay.
Remember the Armenian earthquake?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We met with some Russians last May. They came to my center over here. So we are trying to figure out how we think and so on. And we told them, I think rightly so, that what Gorbachev is going to face, besides the economic issues and changes in the communist world, is going to face ethnic problems, as you can read in newspapers and radio and so on. This is what's going to happen. As soon as democratization is occurring, you know, the Azerbaijanis, Lithuanians, Armenians, they would want to belong to themselves, not to belong to Russians. And our Soviet colleagues told us, oh, no, you know, we are all communists and we love each other, we're all together, we are not going to have this problem. The next day, one of our colleagues came and said to me, oh, I think I understand what you mean. And he told me the following story, which is my example. After the Armenian earthquake, the Russians went to Azerbaijanis, and they collected blood for the Armenian victims. And then they took the blood to the Armenians to give to the victims. The Armenian victims, they would rather die than have Azerbaijani blood.
Hmm.
You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
In America, which is a kind of freak accident of history, we are more melting pot than anywhere in the world that I know of, we may not see the intensity of how ethnic identities and identities of one's own life are so much intertwined. But this is what's happening around the globe. I mean, my understanding is that more than 10 million people died during the last 15 years because of ethnic problems around the globe. And people rather die than change their belongingness. And I'm trying to understand the psychology of this.
Yeah. Our guest this morning is Dr. Vamik Volkan. He is a psychoanalyst. He is the author of the book, The Need to Have Enemies and Allies. He is a professor of psychiatry at the University of Virginia Medical School. He is also past president of the International Society of Political Psychology, which is an organization of people who are trying to do what Dr. Volkan says that he is trying to do, that is understand how individual psychology has an impact on the psychology of nations or the business of nations, how nations deal with one another. Again, questions here are welcome. 333-WILL is our local number. Toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, there are many interesting questions here, and one of the things that I wonder about I mean, obviously, it may be that, that there is in each individual this inborn need to have people with which one identifies positively and with which one identifies negatively. Mm-hmm. But we could say that you could take a baby of any nationality, any yes. ethnic background,
yes.
and if you got to them early enough,
yes.
take them and transplant them somewhere else, and they would be fully capable of adapting to the new culture, the new language, the new way of things. So there's the sort of plasticity involved. And so some of this business, especially the business of making enemies, is learned.
Yes.
It's taught.
Mm-hmm.
So you one of the things I wonder is, why is it that the parents seem to feel that it's important for that to be also taught? I mean, to be inculcated in their children, the people that they should hate.
Yes, I think that I understand what you're saying. You're correct. It is a learned behavior. It is not inborn. And in the book, I describe how it starts around third year of life. And it is still flexible until you go through adolescence. And after adolescence, you may rather die than change your national or ethnic identity. It becomes very, very difficult. If you find somebody who belongs to the whole world, he may have had unbelievable experiences to reach to that idealistic position, and or he's denying that he has ethnic identity. I mean, that's what happens. It becomes almost impossible to separate your ethnic identity from your sense of self. And the parents do what you're saying that they do, not on a conscious level, because parents also, they like to belong.
Hmm.
It is a human need to be belong to a group. And that's why we do these things. We can even imagine the beginning of life when different tribes evolved, and Eric Erickson talks about one tribe wearing this feather and the other tribe wearing another type of feather, and right away they're different. And we always go around and talk about our own group as the people. The others can be less than people.
Mm-hmm. Huh? What another thing that I wonder is that one way to look at the differences between people is that often the differences are really quite small, and in fact, as you say, you know, in times of stress, people can fix on very small things and magnify them and make them very important.
Oh, so I'm so glad you brought this up, because the paradoxical thing. Let's say that you got two groups. And they are different in language, religion, that you have major differences. Would you believe that it is easier to deal with those major differences? And the same thing happens when I go unofficially to some negotiations between the opposing groups. When the differences are major, somehow it is easier to talk about them.
Hmm.
Not to resolve them, but talk about them. No emotions fly. When the differences are minor, what happens then is that you become like similar to the opposing group. And one of the principles that govern ethnic relationship is that you will not be identical with the other.
Hmm.
Because since you see, enemies are real. I mean, if somebody is shooting at you, of course he's real. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If other guys coming with tanks and airplanes and bombing you, they are real. What we are saying is that besides their being real, we put something else on them. And what we put on them are unacceptable things about us.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they have to remain different from others, from ourselves. Otherwise, our bad feelings will boomerang. See what I mean?
Yeah.
If the differences are major, we can control this boomerang effect. If the differences are minor, we are afraid we may not control it. And then we get into more trouble. And we are working with a lot of diplomats, and because if psychiatric insight is going to be useful, we have to do interdisciplinary work. And what I notice is that you get two opposing groups around a table. When they come close to get rid of their differences, that is the time it's most dangerous.
Oh, that's very interesting.
You know?
Uh-huh.
And this is something we are trying to consult with our diplomatic scholars about this.
It seems, though, that you have tried, that is, this organization, the International Society of Political Psychology,
yes,
has organized a number of meetings between adversary groups.
Organization itself is a scholarly organization. But many people, because we who are dealing with this at this level, I mean, how many are we? Not very, very much. So most of us have their own centers and, you know, grants and so on, doing what you say you're doing. But organization tries to remain as a scholarly branch so that we don't get it to be politicized.
Mm.
Yeah?
Does it seem to happen that when you bring people like this together that eventually they begin to think more about what they have in common than what separates them?
Well, of course, because as they tolerate to think that they have something in common, then they stop dehumanizing the other. You know, one group of people will not kill other group until first group dehumanizes the second group. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There are rituals in large group relationships, and on a spectrum, on the one end is that you make the enemy dehumanized. They are less than human beings. Therefore, collectively, you can kill them or treat them badly because they are not like you. They are not human. But if we reverse this process, then they become more and more humanized. Look what's happening between us and the Soviets. You know, they are evil empire. They are Satan. They are not human being. They are absolutely bad. And we say, it is better to be dead than red. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That is what exactly I'm writing about. I mean, we don't want to be contaminated with them because they are not human. And as with the Gorbachev era, rituals are changing tremendously, maybe faster than anybody expected. So we don't say now that they're evil. We say, hey, they may have some qualities like ours. And same kind of things happen in the negotiation table, which becomes very scary for the negotiators who, if they're official negotiators, they are representing their own group's official views. So there is no room for emotions to be played out so that new rituals can develop. And this is why some of us are trying to develop a new type of diplomacy, sometimes called unofficial diplomacy, sometimes called track two diplomacy, which can be a supplement in areas of the world where there are stubborn, unending conflicts, where you cannot really apply track one, official diplomacy, any longer because that has been applied for years and years and nothing worked out. Therefore, we say, hey, let's understand the psychology of these conflicts and try to apply unofficial diplomacies in that we can find out the human impediments, psychological, emotional impediments to peace processes. And then from there you can build up official negotiations.
Uh-huh. Very interesting. I have a caller here I'd like to bring into our conversation. Others are welcome too. Locally, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Here is someone on our toll free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call, and I hope this fits in with your subject today, which is very interesting. My folks were like an immigrant, and there was 9 in the family, and you talk about that conflict. Now, I'm wondering, why it is now that we're all growing, and we just, everybody hates one another. Nobody's close or anything. It's just like complete hate. I don't, but the others, and it's hard for me to cope with it. And I'm wondering, the world, it just seems like there's so many people with this conflict and hate and everything. And I just wondered where I read an article that said that some families are killing themselves due to the stress of hating one another. And that's happening in my family with ulcers and heart attacks and that. And I wonder if you can comment on that.
Well, first of all, I'd like to say how sorry I am to hear that you have this problem. It is unfortunate, and for me to really understand your family situation, most likely I might need to know more, which will not have time. But you are yourself looks like kind of keeping yourself away from this commotion and trying to observe what's going on, and you may take some leadership in it by allowing yourself to absorb some of the bad feelings without giving them back, and you can be a model for the rest of your family, I suppose.
Yeah, see, my parents migrated here from Czechoslovakia
years ago. Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.
Okay, I thank you for the call. Others are welcome, too. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. I wonder how, Dr. Volkan, the meetings that you have helped to bring about as a part of the activities of the Society of Political Psychology, these so-called Track 2 diplomacy kind of meetings, what makes them different from the other kinds of negotiations that that go on all the time, you know, between the U.S. and the Soviet Union, between any groups we could pick that have opposing interests or ideologies or whatever?
Right. Well, you know, there are also variation of this track too. I can only talk about the kind that I and my friends conducted.
Mm-hmm.
The longest one that we were involved in was bringing together the Egyptians, Israelis, and Palestinians from the occupied territories, and for 6 years. And just briefly, we went to Israel and Egypt and selected highly influential people. And these were all done with the blessings of the American government, Egyptian government, and Israeli government. So it wasn't secret. And we selected people who might be national heroes, generals, newspaper people, some psychiatrists, because we wanted to focus on psychological aspects. And even business people, sometimes ambassadors who would come as in an unofficial capacity. So the whole idea is to develop a laboratory in that an influential group from one country comes together with an influential group from another country, and the idea is a process. Unofficial diplomacy, track to diplomacy, is a process. You get these people to get involved in a process in a series of meetings, rain or shine, with a third-party catalyst group which absorbs their feelings. In this kind of meetings, feelings are allowed to be expressed. Hurts are allowed to be expressed. It is not an official meeting where you come with maps and statistics. We talk about more human aspects of perceptions and feelings. And then these people, they go back to their own countries, they write, they talk to their president, they talk to their government people, they publish books, and then they come back after 6 months and we proceed the same way. And through this kind of activity, we were able to develop an unbelievable network. So that when official things broke down, the network could take over and help out for communications and future hope. just in a nutshell.
It sounds as if one of the things that's going on is that these Track 2 groups are dealing with what one might say are the quote-unquote the real issues.
Real issues. Exactly.
And they are the deeper issues,
yes.
and ones that for, you know, that the restraints of diplomacy say that,
yes.
that the people who are doing the formal meetings, the formal government, yes. representatives, cannot do.
Because rightly so. I mean, they are restricted with their government's positions. They cannot do it. But unofficially, they can look and understand the issues at a deeper level, as you said it. And so the whole idea is that I don't want to pass the information to your listener that Track 2 is going to take over and Track 1 is going to disappear. That is not the question. The question is Track 2 will be useful if it evolves and comes to a crucial juncture in that Track 2 becomes Track 1. I mean, we set up things in a way that after a while we feed into Track 1 machinery.
Yeah.
Because after all, they are the ones who are going to make decisions.
We will talk some more in just a moment here with our guest, Vamik Volkan. We're talking about the need to have enemies and allies. It is our topic and also happens to be the title of a book that he has written, trying to get at why it is we seem to have to have people that we like and people that we don't. Our guest this morning is Dr. Vamik Volkan. He is professor of psychiatry at the University of Virginia Medical School. He is the medical director of the Blue Ridge Hospital in Charlottesville, Virginia, and is past president of the International Society of Political Psychology. He is, in addition, the author of the book, The Need to Have Enemies and Allies, published in 1988. We do have a couple of people standing by on our phones here, so we won't keep them waiting any longer. We'll go first to line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like you to spell the name of our guest.
Oh, okay. It is Volkan. That's his last name. His first name is Vamik, Vamik Volkan. I hope I'm pronouncing that right,
yes,
Dr. Volkan.
Correct.
Good. Was that it, or did you have another question?
Vamik Volkan.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, sure thing. Let's go on to another caller. We'll go to our toll-free line.
Hello, Dr. Volkan?
Yes, hello.
Hello, well,
hello.
Good morning. I'm certainly enjoying your ideas and the discussion.
Thank you.
Of this subject, and I'd like to share with you some an interesting experience I've had with cultural bias.
Yes.
Okay, first of all, I am interested in radio and electronics as a hobby.
Yes.
Also being an amateur radio operator, I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, I am, yes.
Okay, right. Well, our national association, the American Radio Relay League, did assist the Soviet and Armenian hams during the earthquake events over there in Armenia.
Yes.
Well, that's beside the point. I'm also interested in the Russian language.
Yes.
And that is also a hobby, and I'm also interested in sociology and psychology and different ethnic groups and different cultures and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I try to combine all of these things.
Wonderful.
Okay. Well, I like to read Russian radio magazines.
Yes.
And I go over to the University of Illinois, mm-hmm. and I'm able to get over there. They give me their surplus magazines and newspapers over there. You know, they keep them for a while, and then
Right. They
throw them out, and then so I go over there, and they let me have them. So some time ago, I brought some of these publications home, these
Yes.
Soviet
magazines,
right, in the Russian language,
mm-hmm.
with a lot of pictures. And the thing about electronics notation, it's pretty much universal. In other words, regardless of your nationality or your language, you can read. If you have this particular hobby or
Right.
electronics, you can read the notation. You know,
Right.
it's an international type thing.
Yeah.
Okay. So at my local radio club meeting, I brought along some of these Russian language publications,
mm-hmm.
and I said, "Okay, I'd like to share. You know, this is very interesting."
Mm-hmm.
And I started passing them around. You know, I was going to give them away.
Yes.
And people would take them.
Mm-hmm.
They would look at them,
mm-hmm.
and this one individual picked it up. He started looking at the pictures and so forth, and he said, "Where did you get this?" And I says, it's from the Soviet Union." And right away he dropped it. He dropped it on the table. He backed away from it like it was some
hot potato.
Right. And I found this very very amusing. Like I don't know. Some of the people actually took them and took them home and looked at them with interest. And some of the people would not even pick them up, not even look at them.
Right.
So that's my comments, and I'll go ahead and hang up. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You have any thoughts about that kind of a story? I'm sure that it is not an isolated kind of a thing. Those sorts of feelings.
That's correct. I mean, your caller talking about an individual or maybe a few individuals, but under stress, I guess the whole group becomes like that, and that's what becomes very dangerous.
Hmm. One thing that you also address in your book, The Need to Have Enemies and Allies, is how national leadership plays into all of this.
Oh, my God.
I wonder if you could talk about that.
Well, that is a very big topic. There is a psychology between the leader and the follower. You know, we know of certain historical leaders, bad or good. We follow them. They change the attitudes. I mean, now we are seeing Gorbachev phenomenon, for example. Okay? But you can also talk about bad leaders or the horrible ones like Hitler. I mean, and as these areas are being studied, what we are finding out is that there's a fit between the leader and the followers. Not all the time, but most of the time. That is to say, the group goes through certain kind of processes or traumas or hurts, and then they prepare a ground for certain kind of leader to come along. And the influence is not only from the side of the leader, it is also from the side of the follower. And some leaders, they update the needs of the group, and they take the group to the left or right or up and down. It's a fascinating process, so that you know the relationship between one group and the other group gets updated and be influenced by the leader, and therefore leader becomes very crucial in these relationships.
One of the things that that I wonder about as well is if aggression between groups is a result of some deep psychological goings on, and if, as you say, that what happens when we decide that we're going to hate another person or another group of people is that we're taking things about ourselves,
right,
our own culture, our own society that we don't like, and we're essentially getting rid of them by saying, well, no, these people, they have all these terrible qualities, and they do this and that and the other thing, and what we're really doing is trying to split off parts of ourselves that we really don't like. To bring a halt to that, then what we've got to do is to be willing to own up to those things about ourselves that we don't like, which can be pretty difficult. And I don't mean to sound, you know, to sound flippant about this, but it almost makes it sound as if we're really going to achieve a peaceful world, we're going to have to put everybody through analysis so they can resolve their...
That will not resolve it either.
No, okay.
Yeah, it's just because we are talking about really, I mean, I don't want to sound pessimistic, and I will tell you why, but we are talking about, as you're describing, which I correctly, you say, I say, that it is obligatory human process, this projection, this putting things onto others and so on. They're part and parcel of human development. I mean, this is how we feel cohesive and more one piece, by saying, hey, this I don't like, and I put over there, so whatever is left to me feels more cohesive, and I have a better identity. And these are human processes. Therefore, we can imagine that the need to have enemies and allies, at least the potential to to have political enemies and political allies will continue throughout history.
Hmm.
However, alongside all this, if this is at the very bottom, human beings, as we develop, we also develop civilized sides. We develop more sophisticated ways of dealing with this or that. So it is not just one thing. It is very complex. But what I am trying to say in the book is that there are conditions in that, in spite of our civilized side and so on, some large group processes, they become absolutely primitive. And they become dangerous, people die, and they become stereotyped. It's almost impossible to change them. And in these areas, it is very difficult to conduct track one diplomacy, and that we need to come in and help out to sort things out with track two diplomacy.
It does. Another of the questions, it does seem that come to my mind, it seems that even if one did decide that there was another group that was going to be your out group, the people that you just decided you didn't want to have anything to do with, and one way of dealing with that would be to say, well, we could put up a wall,
or we
could just say,
tried.
Yeah, we could say that now. Look, we don't like these people, and so we're not going to have anything to do with them. We say we'll draw a line. Say you stay on your side, we'll stay on our side. But of course, that really doesn't work very well. Why is it that it seems that aggression is so often the result of these kinds of feelings? Why can't people just leave each other alone if they don't like each other?
Well, you know, aggression ties us to others more than love. I mean, that's a peculiar thing for me to say, but as a psychoanalyst, that's what I see. And I can give you an example. We become more preoccupied with the enemy than the loved ones. So it's just like a string that we get tied with the other enemy. And that's why we put a wall, and walls don't work because the relationship has to continue. And there are many, many walls. I mean, besides the Berlin Wall, there are other smaller, less known walls all around the globe between opposing groups all over the place.
Let's take it. Well, I've about 10 minutes left here. I'm going to take another caller here in a second. Let me reintroduce our guest. He is Dr. Vamik Volkan. He is a psychoanalyst. He's professor of psychiatry at the University of Virginia Medical School. We're talking about some of the ideas that he discusses in his book, The Need to Have Enemies and Allies. Why is it that we do seem to have a deep need to have both friends and enemies? If you have questions, comments, you can certainly call in and be a part of the program. Locally, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Again, someone here on our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Dr. Volkan.
Yes, sir.
Your discussion about needing allies and enemies and dehumanizing your enemies appear to be facets of propaganda. Like George Orwell, his earlier writings on propaganda, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering, bringing it to national politics, what would you advise a politician to emphasize rather than like an anti-communist rhetoric, which doesn't seem to be working. For example, Ronald Reagan tried to dehumanize the revolution in Nicaragua as communism, and the American people didn't fall in line behind that. I was wondering if you had subjects or topics for politicians to succeed in America without the anti-communist rhetoric.
Well, first of all, let me make a reference to George Orwell. Besides his, well-known novel and so on, he was in some of his letters, which are published, he was fascinated with this topic, And in fact, he wrote some of the best things about his observations of how large groups react to each other, making references to the British and the Indians when British were fighting in India. So I suspect that you can find and read those, and believe me, they are just most fascinating and were expressed in the most beautiful English. Vis-a-vis national politicians, I am not in advising business because, you know, these issues are so complicated. Let's say Nicaragua, I don't have an expertise in this, so I'm very careful not to say much in an area I don't have expertise in. But I understand your question. The answer will be, from my side, is that what we are trying to develop in my center is that we think that this kind of large group issues cannot be handled in this day and age by one field. We need to do an interdisciplinary work, like I, as a psychoanalyst or psychiatrist, I need to understand the emotional aspects of it, prejudices, and displacements, projections, as you suggested, the fears, whether they're warranted or not. I can say things about that. But I need a historian to tell me the history of these nations and these conflicts, because, in a sense, history repeats itself. I need political scientists. So what we are trying to do is that we are trying to develop a center where these issues are examined very carefully in an interdisciplinary fashion, and then we can feed these findings to be utilized by official diplomats. And what they do with it, sometimes it's horrible, sometimes it's very good, depending on who is the official diplomat.
I hope that gets to the question of the caller. We're growing short on time, and I have one other person I want to try to accommodate here. So we'll go over to line number one for another caller. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Doctor, I'm Dr. Richards, and I'm a psychiatrist. I'd like to ask you a question.
Sure.
How much of this do you think goes back to unresolved love-hate-object relations at the age of 3 1/2, et cetera?
Well, if you read my book, you will find out, of course, my book goes in details of child development as I understand it. And it is a time, at that time, that we become more cohesive individuals. You know, we develop I, and I put a boundary around myself. I put a psychological skin. I say, I end here. This is me, and this is you start. And as the child comes to that phase of his life, he will find out that there are parts of him that cannot be kept within himself. If they are kept within himself, it will be disturbing his identity. This is why he puts things out there. This is a nutshell, you know.
That development goes over several years' period of time, as I understand it.
Sure, they start earlier and goes throughout the life, but there are certain crowning periods of life, and 36 months of life is one of those crowning periods.
Any further elaboration that you'd like to give on that?
Do I like to hear?
No, that you would like to give on that.
Well, then there are other crowning periods, as I said, that during the adolescent passage, there's rehauling of all these identities, and they settled again after the adolescence passage is passed. And as I said, by that time, whatever ethnic identity you develop, then in my estimation, that becomes unchangeable.
I couldn't understand part of your language. Did you say re-holing?
You know, rehashing.
Rehashing.
Yes.
I see. Sort of a type of reawakening or a re-stimulation?
Reviewing the, you know, the turmoil that adolescent boys and girls go through is due to figuring out their dependencies on the parents of their childhood, finding new friends. They're expanding their horizon. They're becoming more social beings. And there's a turmoil that we go through. And at the end of this, we develop kind of different type of more social identities. And within these identities are our ethnicity or nationalism. And they are part and parcel of our own senses of self. And they become interchangeable, unchangeable the rest of our lives.
We're at the point where, unfortunately, we're going to have to stop. I wonder if I could just ask one final question about where we are in the world politically right at the moment. As you talked earlier about the fact that it sometimes is easier to get people to sit down and start them talking when they believe they have really big differences, and that once you start to break that down, that actually things become rather dangerous when the big differences seem to melt away.
Yes.
What does that mean, that at this point where there seems to be so much change in the communist world and we seem to be moving closer, that means that it's actually a dangerous time and we should be careful?
Well, yes, I don't know if it's going to be dangerous or not, depending how it's going to be handled, but certainly it has to be observed very carefully by diplomats and by people like ourselves. One danger would be the emergence of nationalism again. I mean, I'm not talking about good nationalism, which patches you up, makes you proud. I'm talking about exaggerated nationalism as these changes are occurring. And, you know, these Soviet Empire looks like, you know, after such a oppressive regime, when it's no longer oppressive, all kind of nationalistic attitudes are going to spring. And how are we going to moderate them so that they do not become dangerous, but become very adaptive and useful and wonderful? That is going to be the crucial issue.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Volkan, for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Rich. Our guest this morning, Dr. Vamik Volkan, is a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia Medical School. He's also medical director of the Blue Ridge Hospital in Charlottesville, Virginia, and is the author of the book, The Need to Have Enemies and Allies, which was published in 1988.